Hey everyone, and welcome to another episode of Captain Hunter's Podcast, the podcast that is dedicated towards bridging the divide between the police and the communities that they serve. Thank you so much for taking the ride with me and with us as we look to do just that, and that is bridge that divide between the police and the communities that they serve. Today's episode, we want to focus on part two of what we started concerning the Ahmaud Arbery tragic shooting and situation. Before we took a look at the legal aspects of what could happen in that case with Professor Seth Stoughton, in this episode, we're going to take a look at the psychological damage and or trauma surrounding witnessing another tragic shooting. We want to look at how the family is going to deal and how the community, the immediate community, as well as the extended community deals when they see some type of what I would call them, and what many people would call violent porn of the tragic gunning down of Ahmaud Arbery. So that's what we're going to be discussing today. We have our returning guest, Dr. Alan Lipscomb. If you remember, Dr. Lipscomb, university professor in California, dealt with us about the trauma that is witnessed or that is suffered amongst many African Americans when they witness another police shooting. If you have not listened to that episode, please go back and listen to that episode. It's in the archives. I believe it's called Dealing with Trauma After Another Police Shooting with Dr. Alan Lipscomb. So he has returned. I'm not going to read his bio because I read it before. And if you don't know his bio and many great papers and work that he's doing, head back over to that episode, the previous episode, listen to that, and you will get a good sense of who this man is. I also want to remind you all that this episode, amongst many other newer episodes, are going to be videoed and placed on YouTube as well. So if you are the type of person, or you know the type of person who wants this information, who needs this information, yet they are reluctant to listen to audio, but they are more the visual type of learner, then have them head over to YouTube, Captain Hunter's Podcast on YouTube. There they can watch these episodes. So both platforms are available, the audio as you are listening to and the video over on YouTube. So head over to Captain Hunter's Podcast on YouTube. So without further delay, everyone, here is the episode as we're going to be discussing the Ahmaud Arbery tragic shooting with Dr. Alan Lipscomb. Yeah, so once again, thank you, man, for coming on, Dr. Lipscomb. I really, really appreciate it, man. And let's just start off with how you're making out with this COVID going on, and you maintaining wearing your mask and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I am maintaining and finding balance. I had to come up with some quarantine goals for myself, some COVID goals in order to be productive and balance and not get so caught up and overwhelmed while still practicing, you know, safer at home out here in SoCal, and wearing a mask and everything. So adjusting, but I am doing well, all things considered.
Good. I mean, that's good. I think to some people have been really developing those quarantine goals. Some people wanted to start working out or working on home projects, things like that. What have been some of your quarantine goals?
Yeah, so I wanted to make sure that I didn't look back and say, wow, I should have wrote more, you know, worked on some manuscripts. I should have worked out a little bit more, taken more walks, or, you know, I bought a bike so I can ride my bike with my children and stuff like that. And so things like that, I set up, like, okay, you're going to get out and do something. You're going to, you know, ride around with your bike and exercise and not stay stagnant during this time, especially because we don't know how long and what it's going to look like. So those are some of the things that I've been doing to help with my own sanity.
Yeah. No, I definitely get it. And I agree. There were some projects I wanted to do around the house. And actually yesterday, you know, we've been quarantined for 2 months now. So yesterday I went to Home Depot and picked up some stuff to start doing some stuff in the bathrooms. So yeah, it is definitely time to get some stuff done. Yep. Also, another one of my quarantine goals, I'm going to have actually do an episode about this, is I actually kind of really switched up my diet. I went to a whole food, plant-based diet, you know, no more meat or animal products at all. So I just started, I'm about 3 weeks into that.
How's that been for you?
It's good. I mean, I think the challenge is just really trying to find some, you know, challenging recipes. but YouTube is the place, man. So I found so many different
business.
Yeah, I found so many different recipes and I created a little playlist for myself. Okay, you know, and I call it a recipe. So I make this, that, and the other, and all that kind of stuff. But so far, I have not gotten bored. I mean, I eat much more than salads. Everything I eat is very hearty. Matter of fact, today for dinner, I'm going to eat what's called a Mediterranean lentil. It's supposed to be detox soup, but it's just, you know, it's just a bunch of whatever stuff you put in there. I put a lot of fruits and vegetables in there, but that's going to be
nice. I think I am eventually going to be moving into that direction.
Yeah. I've been reading a lot about it. Well, actually mostly YouTube videos about it. I had a lady on from a doctor's office. She's a dietitian, talks about the whole plant-based food thing. Yes. And it's just so convincing. And I don't want to get off into that tangent. That's an episode that's going to be coming up.
That's an episode in of itself.
Yeah. So listen, man, we got to talk about this, man. What's going on in Georgia? Here we are again, another man gunned down. And so just tell us, you know, when you first heard about Ahmaud Arbery, what went through your mind? What was the first thing that came to your mind?
So when I heard about it, I actually saw the news clipping of it. And I had a visceral reaction to the video and seeing it, because it's one of those things where you're not prepared, right? You're not prepared for what you're about to see. And I got locked and froze, right? That kind of response. And immediately my heart dropped. You know, immediately my heart dropped. And then it shifted into frustration and anger and sadness initially when I saw it and heard about it.
Yeah. Yeah, mine too. I had first read about it in the New York Times article. I'm like, what the heck is this? And then I watched another podcast, you know, Roland Martin Unfiltered, his podcast. And so I'm watching him kind of talk about it. I'm like, hey, I didn't hear about this. So then, you know, between a New York Times article, between his thing, and then maybe a day or two later, somebody sent me the video. And so I watched it and there was no editing to this video. So we see the man collapse and I'm like, this is crazy, you know? Yeah. And of course I knew the narrative from reading the New York Times article and I'm like, this is not what they said at all, you know? So that's, I really wanted to talk about your reaction, my reaction, and probably hundreds of other black male reactions, black women's reactions as they see their potential husbands and sons and all that kind of stuff. Let's just dig into the trauma, what goes on in our minds, you know?
For sure. Because we have been, specifically over the past decade, we're coming up on 10 years that we have been exposed to this type of trauma, and not to say that it hasn't existed before that, but as far as social media exposure to this and folks having access to phones and recording, we're coming up on a decade. That being said, we are already traumatized. We already are traumatized. It's the equivalent to, I think of it psychologically speaking, to witnessing lynchings. Right. And so there's a part of for some folks, there's a part of this that they've disconnected and disassociated from it because it's too painful and too overwhelming to witness and watch, and rightfully so. And for other folks, there's different reactions too, where they are frustrated, they're sad. We're seeing the activation of their own experiences with being harassed, targeted, be it law enforcement, be it folks policing them because of their bodies being black bodies, et cetera. And so there are many reactions. And this goes back to something I talked about the last time I was on with you regarding the research that I did, the qualitative research I did in response to the murder, fatal shooting of Stephon Clark in Sacramento back in 2018 in March.
Right.
And one of the things that came out of that particular body of research is the responses and reactions for specifically black men who witness, view, or read about what happened to black males who are murdered. And so since that time, I have expanded on that and looking at in coming up with grief reactions, common traumatic grief reactions among Black men. And so the following reactions that I have found to be true across the different research studies that I've done is, one is hypervigilance, right? And in no particular order, hypervigilance. So not only am I reacting to what I saw, now I am responding and reacting to how I'm going to experience when I go for a walk, when I go for a jog. If I wasn't thinking about it before, I'm definitely thinking about it now because of that parallel and that connection to me being Black male body and what happened to Ahmaud. The other thing around that, and I'll give you a quick example that happened to me this morning. So as you know, across the country, universities are closed as far as the campus is, and they're doing a lot of distance learning. And me being a faculty member at the university that I'm at, Cal State Northridge, I wanted to, this morning, I thought about, oh, I want to go and get something out of my office on campus since, you know, we're going to be in this longer than I initially thought and anticipated. Immediately I thought, oh, wait, I can't just roll up on campus. It's empty. Somebody may suspect that I'm coming up there trying to steal something, take some, right? So that hypervigilance piece, notice what I'm saying to you, right? I'm not saying I'm worried about COVID.
Right.
And please don't mishear me with that. I am worried about COVID.
Right. Right.
But what takes priority for me, really, that I'm worried about killing me and taking me out, is someone shooting me, attacking me physically, et cetera, because of being Black male body. That's my fear. That's where I went to. I didn't think about, oh, there's a hand sanitizer. I have to wear gloves going into my office. No, I'm thinking about, who do I need to contact so that folks know that I'm coming? And better yet, even after I leave, not getting a report or hearing that somebody was seen on campus, Black male, you know, my description. You follow?
Right.
So it's loaded and it's nuanced when we think about Black males specifically responding to this. The other piece, going back to grief reactions, traumatic grief reactions to this, is withdrawn, right? So I'm just going to pull back. I'm just not going to go out. You know what? I'm going to cut out that jog. I'm just going to fall back, you know, lay low, let things die down and go from there. I'm just going to pull all the way back. I'm not going to talk about it, possibly, et cetera. So there's that other reaction to it, right? The other one is honoring the person who has died, right? So we see this with, and I'm a back out and not related to killings, but more so related to unexpected tragedies, death of Kobe Bryant. Mm-hmm. The honoring, the respecting, right, of his legacy and who he was and what he meant for individuals across the board, right? And so there's a sense of pride, respect, and honor as a grief reaction as well that I see among Black men and other communities too. The other reaction is acceptance, right? It is what it is. I talked about this before last time, right? It is what it is. You know, we just got to get used to this. We need to be, you know, prepared and aware of how we move and da-da-da-da-da, right? But the opposite of that acceptance is activism. And I think this is something that, although we've seen it over the past years, there was a quickness in the responses from folks. And now I'm moving out of Black folks. And I saw just on my social media feed, more responses and folks doing things around making sure these men were charged, taken in, arrested, that I have not seen prior to what I saw this time around. So that activism piece for Black folks, for folks who are not Black, I saw a different response outside of our immediate community. Because one of the things that becomes frustrating is that, why are we the only ones alarmed by this? Why are we the only ones frustrated by this? Why are we the only ones fed up and tired about this? And so in the middle of COVID, right, I saw a lot of folks, white folks, et cetera, responding to this equal to, if not more, of what's been going on with the pandemic. And I'm not trying to compare, right, the pandemic to this. The last piece that I'll speak to around the grief reactions that I've noticed across the board in doing my research is being triggered, right? Being triggered and activated. And that goes back to the piece that I was starting off with and that hypervigilance piece. So now I am triggered. Now I'm feeling some tightness in my chest and there's a physiological response that I'm having. So what I saw, what I witnessed, what I heard about. So all of these reactions, and there are more, but all of these reactions, I would say, are common grief reactions among Black men and Black folk in general as it relates to seeing these tragic deaths.
Absolutely. I want to ask you about the activism part, and I want to ask you basically a two-part question. I know that we're in the COVID. Have you been in communication with your white peers, and what has their been reaction? And the second part of that is, why do you think that there's so much more reaction to this amongst, and I would say, I mean, the peers are your academic buddies, essentially, but, you know, Facebook people, why is there more amongst the lay people, if you could put it that way, why is there more reaction?
You know, I think there's a couple of things. I think, one, they are finally seeing the evidence lined up back to back to back to back to back. Also, if you're a peer of mine, going back to the question piece, if you're a peer of mine, you're also able to see the reality that I'm facing. Mm-hmm. If you know me, if you know my children, I have a daughter, 12-year-old daughter, I have a 10-year-old son, you're also seeing the possibility of not just me, but my son. And so if you talk about activism and you talk about allyship, right, what does that look like when you're practicing it? We can't just tout that, right? These folks can't just say that they are down for the cause or whatever, Black folks, the community, but then when stuff goes down, you can't find folks. Right. And so I think because of, one, the evidence and also their connection and relationships with Black folks in the Black community, they're having to say something now is what I'm noticing because of enough is enough is what I'm seeing and what I'm hearing. And it's been refreshing just to see that on social media, what folks are doing and how they're responding to what happened. And what has been happening, I think, is the reason why we're seeing a shift, or I'm seeing a personal shift.
Yeah. No, I did see I'm in agreement with you. I did see a number of people that really commented on social media. There was one. I did a video post in talking about the actual video. I broke down the video, and then I broke down the letter that I sent you. And I broke down the letter and what I thought was wrong with it, just from a police officer's perspective.
Yes.
Why the state's attorney should not have written what he did. And so before I started that whole breakdown, I did highlight one particular white guy who said in the video, he actually put a post, I cut out the post and said, you know, here's a guy who gets it. And he said, the only thing that I'm concerned about when I go out for a run is, are my knees going to ache after 3 miles?
That part.
That's what he's worried about.
You know?
Right. And so, I talked to, I did a legal breakdown with a law professor just a couple of days ago. That episode will be coming out pretty soon as well. Okay. And so we talked about, I asked him essentially the same thing. You know, how did you feel when you saw it? And he said he was sad. He was, depressed and angry and all this kind of stuff. And then I said, I felt the same way. And then I said, I was terrified. And he said, that's a good point. He said, because I'm not terrified.
Yes.
He said he understands that the things that happen are terrible, but he understands that when he goes out, if he looks into a house and just sees how the house is built and the frame that's going to be, he has no inkling or compunction that he's going to be followed, chased, harassed, and all that kind of stuff. So, go ahead.
And that's the piece, too, that I saw, too, with other white folks, is they're recognizing and realizing that I don't have to worry about my life and am I going to survive that jog, that walk. I don't have to worry about my boys, right, who are going for a walk, a jog, a hike, etc. So the humanity connection, the difference in how humans are treated, because some folks like to ignore it, right? And I know this is sounding like, yeah, of course the humanity, we're all connected and We're connected, but we have different lived experiences and living experiences because of oppression, because of institutional and historical racism that continues to play out. And I don't know if you saw this going around on social media, but there was a post on Black People Are So Tired.
Did I see that? No, I haven't seen that yet. I'm definitely going
to
look at that.
To you. Okay. I'll read you a little snippet of it if I may.
Okay, yeah, yeah.
So it says, Black people are so tired, we can't go jogging. And then after each of these sentences, it's a hashtag, someone who has died as a result of these different things, okay? So we can't go jogging. We can't relax in the comfort of our own homes. We can't ask for help after being in a car wash. We can't have a cell phone. We can't live a party to get to safety. We can't play loud music. We can't sell CDs. We can't sleep. We can't walk from the corner store. We can't play cops and robbers. We can't go to church. We can't walk home from school with Skittles, right? And it goes on and on and on and on and on. And so it's another way to highlight that just existing for Black folks is seen as a weapon. One of the things Dr. Rashawn Ray talks about out of Maryland, a brother out of Maryland, he says, your Blackness has been weaponized. So just you being is seen as a weapon and a threat.
Yeah, that's some powerful stuff. I had that brother on too a couple of weeks ago, Dr. Rashawn Ray. Yeah, good brother. Yeah, man, I mean, if you can, dig into the psychology of this. I mean, I'm reading a book right now, which I probably am going to put down. It's called, and I forget the author's name, but it's called We Will Shoot Back. And it talks about the Mississippi freedom movement and how the Deacons of Defense came to the aid of, the civil rights movement, particularly in the state of Mississippi. Uh-huh. I think it was somebody's doctoral dissertation. They just kind of turned it into a book. I think that's what it was.
Nice.
And so it's really good. And but just, they talked about, I've heard about this. I I'm not old enough to be a part of the civil rights generation. But man, just the amount of terrorizing and lynchings and assassinations that were going on in just in the state of Mississippi that this author details. And to talk about us being violent, or scared of us. When I had that law professor on the other day, he was talking about a study in which Black males are seen as bigger and therefore more threatening.
Yes.
And so talk about this and why are we seen this way after 400 years of being terrorized and lynched? How do you see us this way? I don't even understand that. We ought to see them this way.
Correct. Well, that's the biggest psychological, I would say, damage, if you will, is because of the long history related to Black folks and slavery and seen as a product and less than human and all of that stuff. It's interwoven throughout who we are, who we say we are as a country. And so the psychology around it is that the narrative is you do not belong here. You are someone to be feared. You're less than, you're not as smart, you're all these things, right? And so when someone is, and this stood out in the letter you sent me from the DA. So when you have a Black male who's jogging in their community, right? And the two white males are going after him because they suspect that he is going to rob or have robbed or whatever. That's their neighborhood. Even in the letter, it says their community, right? It wasn't the community. It wasn't both the victim and the blah, blah, blah community. It was their community. So if this is my land, if this is my space, which we already know that's a hell of a fallacy, right? If this is my space, if this is my land, I have the right to confront you. Another thing in that letter is, although they had the guns, the letter states that they were clearly protecting themselves and they had a right to do that. But let's switch it up. Let's switch the psychology. When we are growing up as children, our parents tell us if somebody tries to grab you, snatch you, fight you, or whatever, you protect yourself. Mm-hmm. Do everything you can do. Let's change the narrative around women and being attacked, scream, yell, make a lot of noise, whatever. You know, we hear these narratives around how you survive if you're being threatened or someone's coming after you, you feel like you're being followed. So Ahmad responding, seeing these two men in a car with their guns coming after him, his response is to protect himself. But the narrative gets shifted. No. They're protecting themselves from you. That's why it was justifiable. You shouldn't have been scared of them because you shouldn't have been there. Mm-hmm. You shouldn't have been there to begin with because this is not your land, your community, your whatever to begin with. So I am doing my service, right? Right? Because you don't belong here, right? So in the letter, it also states that they were doing that until law enforcement gets there. Right, so I can suspect and then do all of this with the idea that I am protecting our community. I am doing this to help law enforcement, et cetera, et cetera. So the psychology of it, it's right there and it's clear in how it impacts how we look at this, how we understand this, and how we continue to move. So it invisibilizes and demonizes Ahmad. Right? Aggressive. They use his mental health in there, in the letter.
Yeah. I highlighted that. Where is it at here?
Yeah, let's see. That's towards the bottom, page 3. Yeah. Mental health records and prior convictions help explain his apparent aggressive nature and his possible thought pattern to attack an armed man. Now, if that sentence is not a fallacy and a contradiction, so he sees an armed man. Because he has, let's go with it, mental health prior history, there's probably a legitimate fear. He may have PTSD. He may have depression, right? And so if he sees someone coming with a gun, this is not psychosis, folks, right? They had guns.
Right.
He's protecting himself. But notice how they spent that narrative. And notice the loaded microaggressive language around aggressive nature. Right. So already he was someone who needed to be killed. And they're also pathologizing mental illness, too.
Man, that's why this letter to me was just so crazy. And for the I'll put this up on YouTube as well as the audio. But we're reading from the letter here and it's just so bananas. He goes through these five steps as to why it's really four steps. The first one is just. I'm a DA and I've been doing this for 30 years.
Yes.
But, you know, it goes to the autopsy. Third one, following the suspect in the neighborhood, in their neighborhood, as you mentioned.
Yes.
Oh, man. Just in the fourth one, they had firearms in open carry fashion. They didn't just have firearms. They went and got them.
Correct.
This letter, and not only to mention, you know, the first part of it is I'm going to recuse myself. And then he goes on to say, I'm going to give my opinion.
Yeah. And this is why, too, Captain Hunter, this is why I called that article regarding Stephon Clark. I titled it Blackmail Hunting. Because you're hunting. You're targeting is what you're doing, right? So you are actively and consciously deciding and choosing that you need to get a gun to kill this person because they are aggressive, they are to be feared, they are X, Y, and Z. So it justifies the killing. And not to mention, what was it, almost two and a half months since this happened?
Right.
And so this is where I appreciate and love social media. Mm. Bringing to the forefront attention, right? What's happening, what we wouldn't ordinarily see and be exposed to if it wasn't for social media and camera phones and you know, leaking videos and all that stuff.
Talk about, we touched on it a little bit, but I want to talk about the trauma justification, right? We talked about the demonizing and the mental health, demonizing of his past history, right? Even the newspaper said that he, you know, took a conviction for larceny or some nonsense. And then at one time, talk about the pathology of always bringing up, at least to my knowledge, particularly in these type of controversial, questionable shootings, that they always bring up the black males' past history. You know, when he was 12, he stole a box of raisins or something.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
Because they have to justify. They have to justify why this person needed to be killed, to be shot, right? Wow. So if we go back and look at anything in their record that can show a glimpse of behavior, aggressive behavior, criminalized behavior, or crazy behavior, that's the mental health piece, then we can justify, oh, this was a crazy person who needed to be shot. And that's the psychology of it, right? So that folks can say, and that's that cognitive dissonance, right? Oh, okay, that's why, right? If only he wasn't, going back to Trayvon Martin, if only he didn't take that shortcut. You know, he shouldn't have been on private property. He should have just went And notice the justification allows the narrative to shift from how do children get home? I remember walking home from school. I took shortcuts, right? And that was acceptable. Take your shortcuts, be careful, et cetera, but take your shortcuts. But that's not okay. That was bad. That was demonized. That was inappropriate. And so therefore, he shouldn't have been there. It is the spin.
Yeah. So on the other side of the coin, right, we have what happens to us. I think I asked you this in the previous time you were on, but I'm going to ask you again.
Sure.
This type of violent type of porn, what does anyone study what goes on in the white mind when this is going on? Those particularly who make these type of justifications, or those who don't care, or don't empathize, or we've talked about those who are stepping out and speaking up. But who is anyone looking at those who are justifying? And what goes on in their brains? Because it's obvious that they don't want to live in the world where this is happening to them. There's no way in the world that you and I as black males could see something going on in our neighborhood, see some white guy going through that, pick up our shotgun, grab our .357 and go chase this guy down and shoot. There's no, come on, this is not even a question. We'd be arrested. You know, we would have already been convicted.
Correct. And what goes on in their mind has already happened before they were born. That's the history piece, and have been conditioned, right, throughout narrative stories, images that play out that makes it okay. So you have to remember that this is seen as their property. This is their country, right? We see the response to Make America Great Again and Trump supporters, et cetera. And so if you feel like, and you've been told that this is yours, and you feel like somebody's coming after that, the psychology is, I need to get mine. I need to get before somebody takes what is rightfully mine, quote unquote, right? And so that allows for that disconnect and not seeing it the same, because it's different. Because this is what black people do, right? Historically, right? They're saying, well, this is what they do. So I need to do this because you can't trust them. You know, these hoodlums, thieves, whatever, et cetera. And so that justifies the psychology. Also, and Dr. Joy DeGruy talks about this around post-traumatic slave syndrome, but if you accept that, you also have to accept the lineage, right, of what your parents, your grandparents, your great-grandparents have done. So if you see it as bad, then now you're seeing your whole history as bad, right, in your family, because they did the same thing. So it's overwhelming to accept the other narrative that is true, right?
That's a really, really valid point. And I've often thought about, and somebody, I was thinking about it for a long time, and somebody else had brought up the question is, what happened to all those people who were, if you look at the lynching postcards and stuff, right? Those people were people's aunts and uncles and grandparents. Right. Right? Some of them are probably still alive in their 80s and 90s, right? Attending these lynchings, right? And they're influencing. And so therefore, they never, some people will never understand that this is wrong, never understand that this was bad. And so, yeah, and it challenges or confirms what their parents and grandparents have thought, no matter where you stand on this, right?
Correct. And if you look at the crowds and folks who are doing this, they're not that old too. Right. And so I, this is the psychology piece for me, and I'll speak for self, right? For the longest time, I would tell myself, well, once that generation passes on, this is a different generation. Once, you know, that generation passes on, they die, whatever, folks are going to get it in a different way because they're not going to have that lived experience of doing this as white people to black folk, right? I needed to tell myself that in order to give myself hope in a larger context outside of the black community that white folks are going to get it as soon as the racist, et cetera, ancestors and all that pass on. But then when you look at what is happening and who these crowds are, they're young. Mm. So then the question becomes, what's the dominant narrative that they're getting? Mm.
Exactly. Right? Exactly. Right. Talk about the trauma that the family is going to be facing. I know the mother could not watch the video. I couldn't watch the video either. I mean, after I broke down the video, I was like, you know what? I can't watch this again. So what's the mother going through, the family, and not only for their own son, yes, talk about that, but also just another, as we mentioned, hashtag, another.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's the pain. That's the pain. And so the mother and the family, that deep sorrow, because, it wasn't to an illness. It wasn't to the COVID-19, right, virus. And because folks are not always recognizing it, it's in disenfranchised loss and grief, too. Because then where do you go, right? Yes, there's support groups and stuff like that, but how do you talk about that? How do you make sense of it happening to begin with? Right. And so I think one of the ways in which these families deal with it is through what we call in psychology as an ego defense mechanism is sublimation. So activism work themselves, right? Speaking to other parents and people around what happened to them so that they can share their journey and support other people throughout this process and also stop it to begin with, changing laws. Right, around their activism work and how they're getting involved with their local, in the city, community, larger political realms. And so we see different reactions as a result of this, but that's that deep sorrow that stays within. Mm. And it continues to play out, that sadness continues to play out. And that's the piece that doesn't get the support and services to help with that depression. Right, to help with that sorrow. So it can really eat away at the individual and the psyche within the family system.
Yeah, I want to I talk about that a little bit. What's the long-term effects of this? For you, for myself, I know what we talked about can almost essentially be a short-term kind of thing, right? We're hyper-vigilant today, but what's the long-term effects of this? I know that, when I saw that, I thought about my son.
Yep.
My daughter with Sandra Bland, what's the long-term effects of this? High blood pressure, et cetera, et cetera. What's long-term?
Yeah, you're touching on the long-term effects is our early death as a result of what we're carrying and being exposed to. And that's why, if I may tie in COVID, that's why we see the different responses within the Black communities, low-income Black communities, not getting the health care and services that they should be getting and testing, et cetera. And so it only exacerbates and highlights the racism, disproportionality, and disparity gaps in health care. And so the result and long-term effects of this is eating away not only at our mental health, but it's eating away at our physical health. So that's the high blood pressure, right? That's the depression. That's the suicidal thoughts and attempts right? Because it's staying with us. Take me out of this world. Take me away from this. Let's stop the pain so we can see that happening as well.
What can people do who don't have access to medical care and they still want to do something to self-medicate? And I'm not talking about drugs. I'm talking about do something to take their mind off of it or get better or not deal with this type of trauma. Because as you mentioned, it will eat at us psychologically and physically. What is there anything that we can do? Would you suggest if you don't have a high, you can't get to a therapist, you can't, or whatever, yep. What would you suggest?
Got it. So venues like this, social support, social media support. There's a lot of podcasts that I'm seeing happening, supporting families, supporting individuals. I look to the church because we have a strong lineage and connection with the Black church and how the churches are supporting and helping folks talk through and process what they're experiencing. So I see the healing is centered around engaging with the community and social support and what that looks like. I think that's where we've always gotten our support as Black folks, is within our family systems, outside of our family systems, within the community. I think those are ways to do it because we get to talk about it. We get to share it and express it and not hold on to the pain and hurt.
There's one, I don't know if you know her, I'm reluctant to say her name. She's a Black political commentator, and she kind of came out and did some Twitter rant or Facebook post or something along those lines and really kind of went off on Arbery. And she received a lot of backlash from Black conservatives who said, listen, this is not the case to go off on Arbery. What is the psychology of persons, particularly of color, who want to defend this type of thing? As you mentioned, we're seeing over and over, and I'm really anxious to see that hashtag about we can't sleep, we can't barbecue, yeah. What is the psychology of those type of persons? Are they just in it for the money? What's going on in their head that they can't see what everybody else can see?
Yeah, I think there could be a combination of pieces and factors that can play into that denial, right? Mm-hmm. So it could be they're trying to get popularity and views and all that stuff and reaction. But the other piece is that the impact of internalized racism as a means for psychological respite. So if I am internalizing this and therefore I have to justify, well, they must be doing this for a reason, right? They must be getting killed for a reason. So in order for me to not allow that to overwhelm me, right, as far as it's my fault, I have to then justify the acts of the other person against Black bodies, right? Because that keeps it removed, right? Because psychologically, if I take that all in, then that means I'm next. That means it can happen to me,
right?
But no, that's too overwhelming, right? So this is why that happened. I need to justify the action so that psychologically I can sleep at night
and live with that. And that's powerful stuff, man. Mm-hmm. We talked about COVID a little bit, and I kind of want to shift. We talked about the Arbery thing. Let's talk about COVID. I wanted to have someone from the Asian community come on and talk about their psychological damage and trauma around being targeted.
Yes.
And so I did end up having a professor on, but he didn't talk about the psychology of it. He just talked about what's going on. But I did talk, and I reached out to a number of different Asian Americans, and two of them told me that they couldn't come on and talk about it because it's just too painful. Yeah. And so, and I'm not trying to make light of the Asian experience.
Sure, yeah.
But this is what Black people deal with all the time. And and it's almost like Bruce Willis in Die Hard, welcome to the party, pal. Talk about their response, if you know anything about the Asian experience, and talk about this, how people are dealing with just depression around the COVID virus altogether, no matter what race we are. We're all dealing with this, shut in, can't go to a restaurant, can't go to the beach, et cetera.
Yeah, well, I don't want to speak for Asians, right? Just like I'm not speaking for all Black folks and all their experiences, but I definitely don't want to speak for the Asian community and population. However, what I can say is that for Black folks, we have a long, deep history of dealing with this type of stuff. Mm. And so for us, we're like, yeah, we see, okay, you next, right? We see this happening to you. There's a part of us that gets it because we deal with this ongoing. And I think there is this narrative that's out there about Asian Americans, Asian Pacific Islanders, et cetera, around the model minorities.
Right.
Right? The model minorities. And so if they are being coined and deemed as model minorities, when now they're being targeted, right? And I'm not saying now taken away from the history of how Asian and Asian Americans have been treated in this country, because there is a long history of that here as well. Mm. But specifically right now, with over the past, let's just take the past decade, right? The past 10 years. There hasn't been this inundation with social media and seeing Asian brothers and sisters being shot and wrongfully killed, et cetera, like it has been for Black folks. And I am by no means trying to do the racist oppression Olympics here, right?
Right.
it's not a competition. But what I am saying is that the reaction, although the fear is the same for Black folks and Asian folks and other folks of color and who are marginalized, but there is also an awakening with this response. And so it's like, how do we reconcile this? How do we do this, right? How do we respond to this? And it is extremely hurtful, as you can see. And the businesses are hurting as a result for those who are owners of restaurants and spas and stuff like that. And so not only are they taking, being attacked personally, but also businesses, right, are being attacked financially as well. And that's also across the board. Among other communities with businesses and jobs. And then so for the second part of your question was what's the impact and how are we responding to this, the COVID-19 pandemic? And we are seeing and we are going to continue to see the ramifications of this COVID-19 pandemic. And what I mean by that, we are going to see increase in anxiety, increase in trauma-related reactions, PTSD, increase in depression. We're going to see increased numbers in suicide and following through with suicide. And so I think while folks are coming together and there's a lot of resiliency that's happening as a response to how we're going to stay together and support each other as a community, there's also going to be some severe mental health reactions and psychological impacts from decades on out from a response to this. Because this is 2020. This is 2020. This is what 2020 is going down for. Mm. And so when you think about that for 9 to 12 months, and we know it's going to go past that, we are actively in a psychological and sociological study right now.
Yeah.
We're in it.
Yeah.
We're in it. So much of this we are going to be finding out, because things will never be the same, right, after this. And so that's what I believe is some of the reactions that we're probably going to see.
I definitely agree with you that this is going to be a study. I mean, not to sound morbid, but I know psychologists and sociologists, as you said, are going to have a field day with the year 2020 from everything. Talk about, if you can, if you know anything about the reaction of the white males, and I hate to always sound so racial. I try to keep this stuff about cop stuff, but it just goes there. The white males who are responding in Michigan, Minnesota, storming the Capitol with guns. Yeah. What the heck's going on with that? If you know.
Well, let me highlight something you just said, because I think it relates to what we've been touching on and talking about. And one of the themes that we've been focusing on throughout this interview is the psychological impact. Your response right now, I hate to sound so racial and be so racial, that's the psychological impact. right? Mm. Is that for us, and this goes back to what you were saying earlier, we think about that.
Yeah.
But the reality is we shouldn't. White people, white males, they get to walk into the Capitol, the state Capitol, with guns and weapons. That if that doesn't tell you about the psychology of their experience and privilege and white privilege and white male privilege and weapon carrying privilege, the fact that they weren't gunned down and dead before they even stepped on the pavement says a lot right there. And it also highlights that Black folks can't do that. We can't even jog, let alone think about getting a gun and walking to the Capitol and in their face, whip the gun. Right? And so it also shows the larger system acceptance of this type of privilege. There's an acceptance. Right. And so let me just highlight one more thing. I know we're coming short on time, but I'm in Southern California and, you know, they closed our beaches and, you know, recently just opened them up with some restrictions for sure still in place. And they were protesting. Mm. Right. White folks was out there. Other folks were there, too. But majority were white folks were out there. If that had been South Central Beach, please believe me when I say this, the whole beach would have been shut down. Matter of fact, they probably would have built over the beach to keep people from going there and doing that. Because the mere appearance of Black folks and Black bodies demonstrates for white folks fear. It's not safe. Oh my gosh, can you only imagine what the narratives and highlight and headlines would be if that was a Black beach? And we were out there protesting about opening our beaches back up.
Man. That is so profound. You talk about this acceptance and, you know, that's what's going on out there in the West Coast. Over here in the East Coast, in New York City, you probably heard about it. And one side of the city, they were beating down Black people and cops were busting heads. And in the same city, on the other part of the city, they were passing out masks.
That part.
The police were passing out masks.
That part. That part.
It's just, you know, and to see this is just, as you said, the psychological and sociological implications of this are going to be a field day for academics to show how wrong differences is. There was a lady who was, and her group of her friends wanted to go to a park, and they went to, this is in Idaho, they went to a park, tore down the, they could run in the park, but the kids want to play in the playscape. So they tore down the tape that around the police line, don't cross tape, tore it down. The kids were playing on it. And the ladies end up taking, or one lady end up taking an arrest because I don't want to deal with this anymore.
Yes.
Denver, or at least in Colorado, some restaurant, everybody's gathering in the restaurant because now, as you mentioned, we can't do that. And I think that just shows just the difference.
Yeah.
And I want to talk about the acceptance before you move on. The acceptance of this is everyone is accepting that this is just the way it is. This is the status quo. This is just the way it is, right? And and just do people view it as if I give it to you as African Americans or as Asian Americans, is it taking away from me, right? I'm accepting of this, right? Talk about that a little bit, please.
So when you say if I'm giving this to you,
giving you the ability to be treated as human, essentially, right? If white people can go to the beach, storm the beach, no problems, right? They'll give out masks and be nice and nice. But if we give that ability to you as African Americans, it's seen as almost as if we're taking it away from us, right?
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct. And that's what we see. So if we do that, because we can't save everybody, right? That's the narrative, right? We can't save everybody. And even when they started doing the testing here in Los Angeles County, it was the more affluent populations and communities that were getting the tested and access to testing. And then when they looked at the numbers and looked at the Black and brown communities, that the numbers were higher, but they weren't having access to testing or it wasn't in their local community, here we go again, right? So who we give it to, the have and the have nots, and who's deserving of life, healthcare, resources, et cetera, it's also that larger narrative. So with the acceptance piece, going back to that, the acceptance is also coping. This is also our coping, right? While it's grief reactions, we are doing these things to survive and cope, whether it's being withdrawn, whether it's hypervigilance, whether it's honor, activism, being triggered. These are our protective factors around our grief and traumatic experiences, which can also, let me just throw this in here, can also indicate that we are also experiencing depression. Both can be true. These can be our protective factors, but we can also be harmed by what we've been exposed to psychologically and is staying with us. So we've learned to protect. Hence why we always stay ready. You know, that's a narrative, right? I stay ready, right? If anything pop off, right? Right, we're quick to run off. We're quick to like, mm-mm, it don't feel right. I'm not going in there. Something don't seem right. This is heightened for us, that hypervigilance, because of our history of having to stay ready.
Do you see, last two questions, do you see any of this changing? Maybe this experiment of 2020 can shed some light and we can get some real education to our schools and politicians. And is any of this changing? Are we just going to be ready for another 100 years? Stay ready for another 100 years?
I think that we're going to see more of this, unfortunately, because it's where we're at and where we've been. But I also believe that there is going to be shifts. I think there's going to be shifts based off what we're starting to see happen. I think in order to do this and continue to push this along, we need to continue to have conversations like this. We need to continue to go beyond having conversations like this and action and activism work. And so it's going to take more than just talking about it in order for there to be changes. And it's going to have to include other folks who do not look like me and you to continue to move.
Yeah, I think that that's definitely key as far as other folks who don't look like you and I. And they, I've said this before, and I'll say it again, is that they started this mess, and they need to fix it. I mean, it's going to take them with activism, them voting, them sitting on juries, sending their police officers to jail, and all that kind of stuff. They have to fix that. Us whining, and not that we're whining or complaining or whatever, but but our activism, our riding in the streets, our protests, it's not doing anything. We have to, and I think that what you said is key as far as them seeing this kind of stuff, whether it was Dr. King in the civil rights movement in the 60s with television, or today with social media. It's exposing a lot of stuff.
It's doing it. We're seeing activism. Things are happening, but we want to see more of it happening.
Yeah, absolutely. So last question, what are you studying now, or do you have anything coming up, or are you going to be part of any type of study about COVID or about this particular incident or other stuff?
I am for sure currently following the COVID pandemic, specifically its impact on the Black community and also Black males. I'm also in the process of looking at Black men with advanced stage prostate cancer.
Okay.
And terminal diagnoses as well, and looking at how they're responding to their own mortality and dying process, because I talk a lot of focus on the reactions responding to other Black folk and Black men dying. And so I'm shifting slightly to look at how Black men are responding to their own death and dying.
Yeah. Well, that's gotta be powerful stuff. You know, I don't know if you know, but I had a triple bypass, and that really that really did something to me psychologically as well. Mm-hmm. You know, I was 45, mm-hmm. it was almost 2 years ago now, and to be told that if we don't do this operation, you are going to be dead within a few days.
So
I can understand that there's certainly a certain psychology that goes along with some words going into your system saying that.
For sure.
That it's almost over, you know, so that'll be interesting to read. And just to tie that back in to what we talked about as far as the whole food plant-based diet, you know, there was a doctor, his name was Milton Mills, Black doctor. He's got a few videos on YouTube. He talks about how dairy is linked to prostate cancer. And so he had a number of uncles who died from prostate cancer. So he takes prostate health amongst black males very, very seriously. I'm actually trying to get him on the show, but.
Oh, nice. Nice. Yeah.
So that's it, man. I really, really appreciate you coming back, man. Great stuff. Powerful stuff. I'm glad that you talked about, I want to leave this off. I'm glad that you talked about what we can do, especially for those people who don't have access to healthcare, whether it's getting involved, going to church, getting it out, listening to podcasts, just getting this information out there, and whatever they can do to have that cathartic relief or release. I think that is really, really important.
Definitely. I appreciate you. Thank you, Captain Hunter, for inviting me back anytime.
Absolutely. Next time is going to be something positive. We're going to talk about how black men are going to colleges or being better fathers. We're going to talk about something good, man.
Do it. We are going to do that next time.
All right.
Talk about resiliency and healing.
Absolutely. Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you. All right.